Hi, I'm Arish Shah, host of the Nothing Ventured podcast. As a CFO that has operated in the startup and scale-up ecosystem for the last decade, and as a founder myself, I found it absolutely essential to learn from those that have come before me. So this podcast is an exploration of the people, the characters, the stories, and the narratives that make the venture ecosystem go round. From emerging fund managers to established VCs, from angel investors to founders, I chat to people that make the tech ecosystem thrive. Please remember to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast because it really helps with our discoverability. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the pod. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Matt Johns. Matt is the founder and CEO of Founder and Lightning, a company that invests in and builds tech companies with non-technical founders. They partner with ambitious non-technical founders and equip them with the team, tools, and expertise and scale to build highly successful technology companies. In today's episode, we talked about the opportunity with AI, but the fact that we're on a clock. We talked about how it is that founders get too quickly into tech without taking the time to validate first. We talk about Founder and Lightning's ambitions to turn themselves into a fund in the future and plenty more. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Nothing Ventured Primer with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really excited to have with me in the studio, Matt Johns. Matt is the founder and CEO of Founder and Lightning, a company that invests in and builds tech companies with non-technical founders. They partner with ambitious non-technical founders and equip them with the tools, team, expertise, and scale to build highly successful technology companies. Matt, great to have you in the studio with
Thank
me.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.
Amazing. Let's dive straight in. So what was your first job?
My first job, I was 12 years old. I worked in my dad's, my family business, mm-hmm. which was a music shop. I think it might be illegal now to do that. I'm not sure. I don't know what the rules are. But my mom told me a story the other day that actually he wanted to get me in there even earlier because the news agents around the corner had their like 5-year-old in there. And she apparently said, no, it needs to be like 12. That was the minimum. So that was my first job. Used to do that on a Saturday morning, then go to football in the afternoon and do like sort of Tuesdays after school. And that was it. I then briefly was a receptionist at a tennis club.
Yeah.
And that's it though. Except for that, I've sort of never done a CV. Never really had a proper job.
Okay. Well, that's probably not a bad thing. Family businesses tend to do that to you. I think I'm in a similar boat. So it sounds like you weren't doing anything before you got into the tech and venture ecosystem. Is that right?
So I took over that business actually when I was young.
Okay.
So I dropped out of university, took that business over at a point when it wasn't really doing very well. My dad had passed away when I was sort of 16.
Sorry to hear
so
that.
So I took that over when I was, I guess, 18, 19.
Okay.
And essentially digitized it. So I took it from an offline business into an online business.
And it was what? It was a record store?
It was like a musical instruments.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Musical instruments. So we supplied musical instruments to councils.
Okay.
So we're in Barnet. Are we in Barnet now?
Yeah, we're in Barnet.
Barnet was one of our customers. Okay. I remember very clearly. Barnet Music Service. It was really tough. It was really, really tough industry. The margins weren't very good. It was a very archaic industry. But I learned loads.
Well, those are the best industries to learn from, right? Because you figure out what doesn't work and then try and sort out what
and
might instead.
Cash was really important, so keeping cash really, really tight. But essentially sort of moved that, changed, rebranded it, moved it from essentially, you know, like an offline business, built a website, did all that kind of stuff. And I was a non-technical founder, if that's the expression, you know, someone that didn't code, so basically learned how to do all that stuff from scratch, not actually code, using partners, using agencies, using freelancers, all that kind of stuff. And that's really what kind of got me into this tech world.
Yeah, so that obviously triggered your move to build Founder Plus, Founder and Lightning.
Correct. So I got out of that business in sort of, you know, about 5-6 years later, and people were coming up to me in my network and saying, oh, I've seen that you've digitized that business. Can you help me? I've got a startup idea. I've got, you know, I've got an existing business I want to digitize, all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of a bit by accident, really. I had some ideas for some tech startups, actually had commitment to raise some money for one of them,
yeah,
but didn't quite believe in it enough. Mm. So I thought, well, instead of doing that, let's harness some of the infrastructure that we'd built up. So, you know, I'd used web developers, I'd built stuff. So I'd had like a team that I could call on from India. And we did that instead. So yeah, it was a little bit by accident. And I never really wanted to build like a big agency, although we kind of are now.
Yeah,
we're like 100 odd people with all the infrastructure that goes with that. But kind of as we went, didn't mind because we're always taking equity in all of the companies that we're working with. So a little bit like a VC, a little bit like a agency, a little bit like an accelerator, sort of this hybrid between all of them.
I know the pains and the potential for that sort of a model. In fact, like, we found it's actually really difficult to convince people to give us equity for services. So I will be picking your brains about how that works down the track. So what would you be doing if you weren't supporting founders in this way?
I guess I would probably have a tech startup. Or what I'm really interested in, and part of our thesis, is to digitize existing businesses.
Yeah.
So a company that's, you know, already going, that's got revenues, has got customers. Because the hardest thing when you're building a tech company, as you'll know, is getting to product market fit.
Yep.
You know, so I've been doing this for almost a decade now. So unfortunately, I've seen a lot of failures as well as wins. And there's kind of like the key tenets that often link them all together, the reasons why they fail. Getting to revenue is really, really hard, obviously.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in how can you digitize existing businesses, because there's so much opportunity. So probably if I wasn't doing this, I'd be doing that.
Okay.
I'd buy a, you know, buy an existing business and digitize it. And that's probably something that we'd like to do in the future as well.
Yeah. Another thing that I probably need to talk to you about as well. So let's talk about founder enlightening specifically. So what sort of founders should work with you? What sort of stages do you work at? What sectors, what geographies, how does it work, I guess?
So we are extremely sector agnostic. Like we really don't care what we go into, because the type of founders that we target are domain experts.
Yeah.
So they have the domain expertise. They know their industry inside out. And then we help them with the tech and we help them with the product. We're very set on B2B. So we prefer to do B2B over B2C for a few reasons, mainly that it's less risky. Mm. It's easier for the founder to sell. Mm-hmm. There's less issues with loyalty and scale, and it's easier to raise money. So typically, we would work with a founder that doesn't code, because that's what we bring. We bring the tech, we bring the product. We have sometimes worked with founders that have a CTO, and they're just looking, they're still looking for the product and the wider tech support. But in general, where it works best is when the founder is a domain expert. They have either started a business before, or they're quite clearly very capable of running a business. Mm. We don't want to hold hand too much, because otherwise we may as well just do it ourselves.
Yeah. Which presumably, if one were to be slightly Machiavellian, you could absolutely poach ideas if that were in your interest, right?
If that's what we wanted to do, but
we've got unethical.
Well, it's not just that. You know, we don't have any interest in operating.
Yeah, got it.
The companies,
sure.
Like, we want to work with founders and guide them and help them. And essentially, we fit into that skills gap that they don't necessarily have. Mm. And so even some of the founders we work with have started businesses before. They've even maybe exited businesses before, but typically it would be their first tech company.
Yep.
And essentially our job is to, you know, make sure that they don't make the typical mistakes that founders make.
That I've made,
That I made, you know. A lot of the stuff that we do now is based on the fact that I made a ton of mistakes in those first 4 or 5 years of trying to digitize my first business. And, you know, you look back at it now and it's like, well, obviously that wasn't going to work. But, you know, very, very smart people can make those mistakes.
Yeah.
So our job is to help them and guide them and push them in the right direction.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that when we get to the main podcast for sure. One question, I guess, within that, are you looking for venture scale style businesses or are you interested in kind of like, so you talk about, you know, digitizing existing businesses or business models, right? Like, would you look at businesses that are more or less lifestyle or might grow to $10 or $15 or $20 million, or are you looking for venture scalable?
So we're getting in typically at a sub $2 million valuation. Mm-hmm. So if those companies exit for 20, we're very happy.
You're happy.
The founder's very happy.
Yeah.
I think there's a big issue with certain VCs pushing founders to scale too hard, too fast, and not really being bothered whether it works out for the founder or not. So we are we're not looking for unicorns, and we don't want moonshots to to save the rest of the portfolio.
Yeah.
You know, we work extremely closely with these founders on a day-to-day basis, and we would much rather have exits that are sub 100 million, mm-hmm. but have more of them, mm-hmm. than yeah. the other way around. Now, it's not to say that we certainly wouldn't argue if one came along,
yeah.
But we're not relying on them. Our model doesn't rely on them.
Yeah, you're not looking for the outliers only. You are.
We're not.
You want to build a base of like Correct. Strong, profitable, valuable Correct. Businesses.
And I think, you know, there's this misconception for founders that VC is the only way to go. And actually, you know, a lot of our portfolio companies have now raised VC money. You know, so it's not like we want to get them venture backable, but then we guide them to maybe, you know, work with a VC that's not looking for 100x return.
Yeah.
You know,
there are not many of those, but yeah.
But they do exist. They do exist.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, the founder, if the founder sells for 20 million, they don't have to work again.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
100%.
And what we found, and I don't have huge amounts of data for this, but this is, you know, fairly anecdotal, but I think it's hard, of course it is, but I think it's easier to get to a 20 million than it is to go and sell for 100 million pound plus. And it sounds obvious, but why not do it then?
Yeah, well, I wrote about this a little bit earlier today, I think, but the reality is I think we all get caught up in the, you know, in the veneer of success that, you know, is shown to us on LinkedIn and Twitter and TechCrunch, yeah. and all these things. And I think a lot of founders, especially because a lot of younger founders tend to be slightly naive and slightly kind of, you know, believe themselves to be a bit immortal. They don't quite understand what the journey looks like when you take on venture capital, which is a really tough journey. Like Dan Bowyer from, mangled his name a little bit, but from Superspeed just wrote about this again this weekend. You know, he was really candid. When you take venture money, like there, you know, if there are five things in your life, choose three of them because you're not going to be able to do all five, sort of yeah. thing.
I just think there's this massive opportunity for people not to chase that.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
If you look at most of the exits in this country, then they're in the tens of millions.
Yeah, I mean, look, I obviously speaking to a lot of VCs, there is a lot of, I guess, angst about the fact that, you know, there aren't those.
Yeah.
Massive unicorn style exits, and you know, part of the reason for that is an inefficiency, as they would see it, in the kind of IPO and the larger market, right, in the private, in the public markets, some of which has now been unlocked with the pension reform, with the ability for pension funds to invest. But yeah, look, I mean, I think there are, you know, there is this question here in the UK and Europe is like, why aren't there more unicorns, and how do we grow that? But equally, and I think this is as valid and invaluable as anything else, because of the way venture works, where, you know, 90% of businesses are likely to fail within the first 5 years. If those 90% of businesses that failed instead were not chasing unicorn valuations, but were going for, like, you know, significant but manageable growth and value, maybe we would see, you know, more employment, more value creation, and potentially, you know, more growth in the ecosystem.
I think it's very hard to replicate the ecosystem that, say, America has.
Yeah. We're 20 years behind, I think, is the other. But, even 30 or 40 years behind. Yeah.
Do we want to replicate it?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah. might be a question you want to take up with Rishi and yeah. Jeremy, I think, in that case. Just before we close off the primer, if there were three ventures that you're excited about, either inside or outside the portfolio you have, what would they be?
So I'm not accused of being biased on our books. We've got 35, I think, 36
sure.
now.
Sure.
So I'll talk about our two most recent investments. So there's a company called Cake Drop. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, a real show of how we maybe invest in things that are slightly quirky or slightly different to yep. the typical VC. So it's a corporate gifting company.
Yep.
So they actually own a bakery.
Nice.
So they provide, you know, cakes and treats and stuff customized for corporates.
Yep.
So when we invested, they we did all of it on spreadsheets, a WordPress website, and have done really well to get where they've got to. And now our job is to turn them into a tech-enabled company.
Yeah.
So not necessarily a pure tech company, but tech-enabled.
Yeah, make the processes replicable. Yeah.
And this is where the opportunity is with these types of companies. It's not just on the front end. It's not just what the customer sees, although, of course, that's important. It's behind the scenes. Mm. You know, how can you automate things so that they can hire less staff or not have to hire as many in the future? Mm. How can they improve their gross margins? So we like to do some of the, you know, some of the boring stuff that maybe, you know, people don't really often consider a, you know, a tech company, because it's not necessarily what the customer sees.
Sure.
Another recent one, a company called Oya, Oya Kitchens. They are a marketplace for dark kitchens and spare capacity in pubs. They basically connect food brands. And yet again, they're sort of building all the admin, all the administration for those companies. So solving like a real need. We're really excited about those two. They're our two most recent. And then I'll talk about one of our oldest investments that now at Series A, and that's one of the companies that has now raised VC funding. Mm. And yet again, our thesis is all around trying to do like one thing really, really well. Mm. So all it does quarterly business reviews. That's it. So Torvet does quarterly business reviews.
What's the name of the business?
It's called ClientShare. Okay. So they've now raised Series A funding. James, the founder, non-technical, extremely commercial, which is a big part of what we look for.
Yep.
So if a founder is, you know, non-technical, I'm trying to move a different word away from non-technical, because I actually think it's a bit too negative.
Sure.
But essentially, a founders that don't code,
yeah.
You know, what they need to be good at selling, right?
Yeah, because I consider myself technical. I can code up to a level,
right,
but I couldn't write a software program. Like, yeah. I can write a little bit of Python code.
That maybe understand.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think is important to try and understand the process. But yeah, they just do one thing really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing really well. I think they're in something like 30-40% of the FTSE 100 companies now. So it just shows, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this later on, but you know, one of the mistakes that founders make is just trying to do too much.
Yeah,
and actually,
always.
If you just skinny it down and just do one thing really, really well, you've got a much higher chance of success.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the biggest pieces of advice I give to founders when I look at a pitch deck. It's like, why have you got 13 revenue streams here? Like, there's no way you're doing all of this stuff. Do that one thing that you actually are doing and that you have proof points around, and don't worry about the rest of it for today.
Totally.
Matt, awesome. I'm really looking forward to getting into some of the detail in the main episode, but thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
Cool. Right, we'll dive straight into the main one. Matt, great to have you in the studio with me today. It was really good understanding a little bit about your background in the primer episode. And for the audience, do check that primer episode out. It'll give you a bit of an insight into how Matt got to doing what he's doing today. But in the meantime, let's dive straight in. At Founder and Lightning, you work with non-technical founders. What are the most common mistakes that you see made by these sort of founders when they start building or by the time they get to you?
So I think it's really interesting in that there's these common themes that you probably see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? As a first time tech founder, and you could have started a business before, you might have even exited a business before, but when you come to build a product, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And look, this list I'm about to give out isn't secret. You know, there's people are talking about this all the time.
Sure.
But I've genuinely seen firsthand that I would say number one biggest problem is that founders build something where the problem just isn't there.
Yeah.
It just isn't there. It's a nice to have. I think
the
expression that I heard quite recently that I liked was it's a vitamin, not a painkiller.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, clearly these founders, they want to build something, right? They're at that stage in their life where they're like, right, I want to build something. I want to run my own thing. And I think that there's this bias kicks in, which is like, okay, this must be an amazing idea.
And it has to be a tech solution.
And, you know, it must be this. And, you know, I've got this problem. I've got this use case. And they just don't go and do the validation to prove that anybody else has the problem, or that it's big enough, or that the market's big enough. So I think that's the single biggest problem that, although I think actually now timing has actually outvoted that. So maybe people are doing things at the wrong time, too early, the technology's not there, people's user habits aren't ready to change yet. So both of those two things I see a lot. But then, if the problem is there and the timing is right, then the actual process that founders go through to build constantly the same problems over and over and over, and that is spending too much money on MVP and it's building too big an MVP and taking too long to launch. You know, without a doubt, I consistently see that, and the founders that we work with, we're constantly challenging them to, can you descope? Can you take things out? Can you just launch? And you'll often find that they say no, but when you really dig into it, they can.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've had on the podcast before Jonathan Sun. Jonathan is sort of raising a fund to invest in kind of businesses at prototype stage, right?
Yeah.
So not MVP, not prototype, but like literally validation stage, like, you know, that they've gone out and they've done the, you know, the survey, the questionnaire, they've spoken to the 1,000 or the 100 or the 500 or however many it is, users or companies or whatever they need to talk to validate the idea before they spend a single buck on on building, right? Which I guess is slightly counterintuitive, right? Because as a essentially an agency, right, like you are there to build. So, you know, if I'm a founder and I come to you and I'm like, okay, we haven't built the MVP yet, or, you know, we want to build an MVP. Surely it's slightly, you know, it's almost not in your interest to say, no, don't build an MVP yet. Let's go and do this stuff. Like, how do you kind of...
Well, with our model, we're investing.
Yeah, so, of course.
So we're actually investing cash. So there is absolutely no point in us building something that we know isn't going to work.
Mm.
But it's really, so I think in one respect, it is easier than ever to start a business now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Because you've got no code, you've got this AI stuff that is just going nuts.
Yeah.
Easier than ever. But I think in a way, it's harder than ever to scale.
Yeah.
Because there's so much competition, there's so many SaaS products, there's just so much, you know, so many products out there. But also, because of no code and because of, you know, OpenAI and stuff like that, big corporates, they can build their own versions of these products.
Yeah, they're just building microservices internally.
Building little microservices internally. So, you know, I really encourage founders to really, really, you know, look at it and make sure they're not being biased. You know, actually go and talk to people, you know, build prototypes, do all that kind of stuff. But then eventually, yeah, you have to go for it, right?
Yeah.
You have to go for it and be fully prepared that you're going to have to pivot. I think something that we see a lot is that founders get totally hooked on the solution rather than the problem that they're solving.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and like I say, none of this is rocket science, but it's amazing how many smart people continue to make the same mistake over and over and over. And it shouldn't matter what the product does, right? It should matter that you're building a successful company.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I actually don't know what the reason is. I don't know whether it's a need to be proven right or what, but, you know, building the wrong solution is massively something that I see go wrong over and over and over. And you know, and people have spent $200,000 building an MVP.
Yep.
It's taken 9 months to build it, launch it. Nobody uses it. They've run out of money, and the business dies.
I mean,
business dies before it even starts.
I've like the number of founders I've spoken to, especially over the last few years, raised £1.5-2 million.
Don't launch anything.
They got 50 users, and they're going out to try and raise the next round at, like, you know, a significant increase on the valuation, and they're just like, well, no one seems to want to invest. Why is that? And I'm like, well, there is a reason for that. I think, and like having been through that process myself and that situation myself, I would say my kind of reflecting on my own rationales, I would say that in part there is this sort of desire to go out and do what other people are doing. So, oh, other people have raised money. Yeah, I want to raise money. I want to do some stuff, right?
Totally.
Secondly, tech is, you know, consistently sort of put out there as being the solution to everything. So if I'm going to build anything, it has to be a tech business, right? So that's the second problem. Third thing is you have a narrow frame of reference. So you may have seen the same problem 10, 20, 30 times, maybe even 100 times, right?
Yeah.
But even 100 times is a very, very small number in the grand scheme of things, right? And maybe it just happens that you were in those 100 businesses or whatever that had that particular problem. And maybe 100 is enough, maybe it isn't. But if you don't speak to the 1,000, you won't really know if that's 1%, 10%, or something bigger, right? And then I think the biggest problem, and this is what it all comes down to, right, is that we are ultimately human beings, and founders are human beings. Ego comes into play. Your ego kind of, I think, gets very wrapped up in both the business, which is a problem when you're a young founder and things go south. You get really kind of anxious and start taking on some of the business's problems as if they were your own. And I think the second thing is, you know, it is ego in the sense that you conceived this idea that you thought was brilliant, being told that it isn't.
Yeah.
Is really hard. It's a tough pill to swallow, but actually it is the best pill to swallow because that's the only way you learn and grow and
you have to pivot. You have to experiment without killing the business. You have to protect the downside, you know. So I think people go all in. Founders, they go all in on their solution, all in on their idea, and then if that doesn't work, there's kind of nothing left. Also see founders partner up with the wrong tech person. you know, there seems to be this obsession with finding a tech co-founder. I think it's really dangerous.
I feel like properly seen at the moment.
I think it's really dangerous because I think as a founder that doesn't code, you presume that the hardest thing is the coding, of course, because you can't do it.
No, it's the product.
It's the product. Yeah. It's the product. Product. Building the right thing, that's the hardest thing. There are loads of, you know, developers out there that you can either hire or work with agencies or work freelancers or whatever that you don't have to give the co-founder title to.
Yeah.
You know, so I think maintaining that control as a founder is absolutely vital. So I always recommend to founders, unless you know this person, unless you've worked with this person for a long time, why on earth you think you're suddenly going to, you know, get into this business relationship and it's going to go beautifully well? You know, and just because someone is a CTO or a techie, it doesn't mean that they know about product.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't know that they mean about design, doesn't know they know anything about, you know, commercials. So I see that go wrong a lot. And it's a shame because yet again, the business is kind of dead before it even starts.
I mean, it's interesting, again, going back to your point about competition and so on, and equally your point about kind of CTOs and co-founders. So when I launched one of my businesses, I did exactly that, hired in CTOs. And actually both the CTOs that ended up working with me were great and really good and understood product as well as coding. But essentially we're still reliant on me, not reliant on me, sorry, that's the wrong way of putting it. But, you know, I was driving the product, and actually because I hadn't gone out and really figured out what the product should be, I made the wrong decisions. It's very hard to admit that, but equally, you know, I have no issues admitting it. I think the second thing that happened was when I realized that, which was when we launched, got great feedback, but then realized there wasn't a market for it, I was able to pivot immediately because I was like, oh, okay, this isn't working. We need to do something different.
Yeah.
And I think the thing is, really great coders love coding, and therefore,
yes, correct,
they will try and solve a problem even there isn't a problem to solve, right? And I remember this with my first CTO. You could tell he was someone that was itching to build, and that's just the nature of how he is. And I think a lot of founders get caught in that trap of, okay, like, we're building now, excellent, right? Let's start shipping or let's start doing something. And then actually when it comes down to it, you get into that problem. The second thing was, you know, I built almost, and I said, like, I knew what was going on in the market. But then when I turned around after we launched the product, the first product that we built, I turned around and there was like actually 30 different people out there doing a variation on the theme of what we were doing. And I was like, oh, actually, this was a really stupid idea because not only are there so many people doing it that this is going to be a really hard market, but clearly no one owns that market and therefore it's going to be a really hard market to break. But B, there are 30 other people doing that and some of them have raised 20 million and 40 million and whatever it might be. And therefore you're just going to struggle to kind of put your head above the parapet, right?
Finding a niche, I think, is so important.
Exactly.
Finding a niche, you know, and it doesn't matter if that niche is really small and really tight. I think some people actually think the market needs to be bigger than it actually does, you know, and
well, they try and attack the whole market,
the whole
first
market, right? Just do a small subset of it. I think the wrong team,
yeah,
the wrong team from day one is a big reason why, and you know, and it gets really messy.
Yeah,
it's really messy. I think as a founder, if it's your idea, you know, stay in control of it. Stay in control of it. It doesn't mean you know, learn, listen, be extremely open, be extremely humble, because you're probably going to be wrong almost about everything. But why make it even harder by having a co-founder there that you're going to, you know, butt heads with? Now, that doesn't mean, I mean, I've got two co-founders and were brought on not from day one.
Yeah.
They're in the business from day one. But
They weren't made co-founders on day one. Yeah.
You know, and it was when they realized, okay, this is perfect. This is an amazing relationship that we've got here. Then it made sense.
Not to kind of keep talking about what happened on my side, but I actually found when I ran out of money in that business, it was easier to find the right quote unquote type of co-founder because there was zero expectation of a salary. There was zero expectation of anything else. And actually exactly as you said, it turns out it was someone that I'd worked with for a long time that I knew intimately.
Trust.
Absolutely. A huge amount of trust because of the nature of what we were doing at the time. Just the difference, I think, even in my own kind of, like, I don't have a problem now that we may not be building or we're building slowly or whatever, but it's like, I know that whatever we do build, if we end up building anything, will actually be.
It's a bit harsh to say this to founders, but I do say it.
Yeah.
If if you think that you've got a pre-product idea and you're going to attract a high caliber technical co-founder, you're mad.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, why on earth would an incredibly talented developer, when there aren't enough in the world, let alone in the UK, why on earth are they going to come and join your startup? They should be earning £250,000 somewhere.
Well, this is the thing. And in fact, the same guy that I'm now sort of working with, you know, he said to me once, he goes, the problem, engineers are highly risk averse individuals for the most part, who plan their lives in the same way that they write code, right? Like, I mean, it is very, very detailed plan of how things are going to go and how it's going to work. And then to go and work in a startup is the riskiest thing that they're likely to do, right? So actually being able to reconcile those two things is
especially when they know they're so employable.
Yeah.
They're so employable. Yeah. They can be earning so much money. You know, the thing is with what we've been talking about over the last 15, 20 minutes, it's really negative.
Yeah.
But it's only because these are the reasons why, you know, a lot of founders are not succeeding.
Yeah.
You know, and they're easy things. There really are easy things to change.
Yeah.
And go in with your eyes wide open.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. And look, I mean, just sort of changing tack, but kind of on a related note, you're focused on B2B versus D2C. Why does that matter, especially from a technical perspective? And what are the main differences in approach?
So just before I answer that, there's the final thing I would say on some of the mistakes is I think founders often go too quickly into tech.
Yeah.
So I don't think founders realize they can prove things offline first. You
know,
if you've got an idea for something, prove it as a consultancy first. You know, if you're the domain expert, go and sell yourself, you know, to some clients. And then if you can build up $5,000-$10,000 a month of revenue, then you're building that product around some actual people that actually want it.
Mm.
So I've seen a lot of people do that and it works really well. That's probably my sort of number one tip to someone that wants to build something at the moment is to prove it offline first. The reason why we go for B2B over B2C, it's all about, I mean, we're basically in the game of doing something incredibly risky and trying to de-risk it, right? So we're building startups, you know, we've got 100 odd employees, you know, we're raising money, we're investing. It's really risky, you know? So our job is to try and de-risk that as much as possible. How can we, what can we do with our model to improve our chances of success? And what I said earlier was, you know, we're not looking for moonshots. So we don't want one out of ours to succeed. We want way more than that. You know,
sure.
Ideally all of them, it probably won't happen. So we believe that one way of doing that is to focus on B2B rather than B2C, because B2C, you know, it's way riskier. It's harder to raise money. It's harder to acquire customers. Those customers are less loyal. They don't spend as much money. If you're building a B2B business, you know, it's a lot easier to spot the gaps within enterprises. They have big budgets. And then I think a big thing as well is that as a founder, you can be the first salesperson. So if you're selling B2B, then, you know, you can literally, it's old school annoying thing to say, one of those things your parents used to say, like pick up the phone, you know, mate. But you can literally go in.
Does anyone pick up the phone anymore? I don't know. Yeah, like
maybe metaphorically.
Yeah.
But, you know, that whereas you're building something B2C, it's you're very reliant on having a really good digital marketeer, right?
Yeah.
You know, so either using an agency, which often founders can't afford. So, you know, I see founders all the time, they're spending like $2,000 a month with a marketing agency and expecting some kind of crazy return on their investment. It's just not going to happen. The marketing is not going to happen. So, you know, if I was a founder and let's say I was, I don't know, like a hairdresser, and, you know, I said, I want to build the Uber for hairdressers, I would go, no, please don't build that. It's almost definitely not going to work. You know,
I used to work with one. With the Uber for hairdressers.
Really?
Anyway,
It's hard, right?
Yeah, it's bloody hard.
Really hard because it's really hard to get the scale. So you can prove it. You might be able to prove it in, you know, one tiny part of London, for example. And then, okay, I've got something. How do you scale that? You know, I would encourage founders to go and talk to other hairdressers and find out what their problems are and build solutions, you know, for their back office, you know, because ultimately, do you want to build a successful business or not? Then if so, focus on those boring, underserved problems that you can
turn it into a SaaS business that essentially provides, I don't know, scheduling tools and VAT return or whatever it needs to be, right?
You know, and and that is where I believe the you know, the lower hanging fruit is.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not to say, of course, there's going to be huge B2C businesses that are built and they're going to be extremely successful, and you know, it's just not the game that we play.
Yeah. But equally, I mean, like those D2C businesses, like look at Be Real, for example, like it, you know, numbers went off a cliff at the back end of last year.
Yeah.
Threads, you know, I saw some stats earlier that, you know, yes, obviously fastest company to get to 100 million users or fastest product to get to 100 yeah. million users rather, but that's because they were able to unload the Instagram.
Unload to Instagram, yeah.
Right? But actually their retention after 7 days is the worst in the yeah. industry, right? Because yeah. because essentially people are like, well, I've already got Twitter.
it's really, really
yeah.
hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. And it's, yeah, it's just, if you're going to go and build a tech company, why not make it a little bit easier for yourself by focusing on corporations as opposed to individuals
that have money and
are
going to spend it.
Yeah.
And so again, like talking about the portfolio, then you've supported over 30 companies. I think you said 35 companies now, yeah. raised over 30 million
yeah.
And a combined valuation north of 100 million. So you could argue that you could describe yourself as an accelerator, an incubator, venture yeah. builder of some nature,
yeah.
Or even a fund, right? So do you plan to build this into a more formal vehicle? And yeah. how does that then change the way that you select the sort of business you work with, to your point around, are you chasing unicorns, are you chasing zebras, I guess?
Yeah, so we essentially started the business sort of 8 years ago. It was more of a traditional agency that we basically discounted our fees in return yep. for equity, and we helped founders raise informally through connections. And then that kind of moved on to a bit more of an informal syndicate. So it was kind of knowing that money was there that we could connect them up with. And now it's more of a formal fund without it being a regulated fund yet, because mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure you probably know that the structure of that is quite difficult to do, but we're in the process of doing that now. So we've started our next fundraise, which will be probably between 6 and 10 million,
mm-hmm.
Which we hope to close by the end of this year, mm-hmm. and that will be more of a formal fund. How does it change what we look for? No, I don't think it does. We still believe that with our economic model, we're not looking for outliers, we're not looking for moonshots. Still very going to be very tight on our niche, looking for underserved niche businesses, looking at founders that are commercially very savvy, that are domain experts. I think the big thing that we will do more of is what I spoke about before, these offline to online.
Yep.
You know, these existing businesses that haven't got the technology there, that we can go in and we can you know, the great thing about those kind of opportunities is you can invest as an investor. What's great as an investor is you can invest at an analog multiple,
mm-hmm.
you know, so if something is making 500k a year of profit, you know, you should really be able to invest at 3x that. Whereas get in there, digitize it, you know, even on today's multiples, you should be at 3 to 5 times revenue once you've completed that digitization. So there's a huge opportunity there, you know, and we want to almost not be competing against other VCs. We want to kind of just find our own,
yep.
our own niche. So more of that is what we're going to do. And then, you know, the long-term plan is to eventually buy those type of companies. And you know, for us and our studio business, it's the same thing, whether we own them or whether we invest. So
yeah,
it'll be a mixture of that over the long term that we do.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the challenge is always going to be, well, I guess, not the challenge, but it's then finding LPs, I guess, or like investors into the fund that
yeah.
buy into that narrative, are happy with that. I would imagine.
Easier now than it was.
I was going to say, right now, it's probably a better bet yeah. than like, you know. Okay.
Honestly, when 2 years ago when we were having these conversations, like, it's very esoteric. It was very niche. It was very like, but what do you mean you're not looking for unicorns?
Yeah.
I mean, we were almost like, I'm having conversations. Like, what do you mean? Now it's like, okay, yeah, makes sense, because the whole market has shifted.
Yeah.
You know, so if you can say, look, we're going to invest into, you know, some of our recent investments, they are solid companies that, if for whatever reason the digitization didn't work as well as we hoped,
they're still going to
do well. They'll probably yeah. pay dividends over yeah. a period of time. The investors yeah. will get their money back.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's something to be said for that, but if the digitization does work and the scale does go, then they're going to get 10 times their money back.
Mm.
You know, so yeah, like I say, probably never 100 times, but 10 times.
Mm.
So yeah, it's becoming way easier, that conversation with LPs, which is nice, because we've been talking about it for quite a few years.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's one of the arguments I hear a lot, right? Like, why are we not creating, as we've said earlier, like, why are we not creating more valuable businesses rather than a few ultra valuable businesses, right? And I think that isn't just a shift in the investing in the investor's mindset. It has to be a shift in the founder mindset as well. And I think, you know,
100%.
As founders, you know, we really need to figure out what is appropriate for us, right? I mean, I've had a few guests on the podcast Emmy Faust, who I actually, oddly, I think she was asking, like, who's a great agency to use to build. Your name came up.
Who is she?
Emmy Faust. She runs
just
agency.
Female.
Yeah,
we're going to one of her events tomorrow night.
Okay, excellent.
We're sponsoring one of her events tomorrow.
Okay, amazing. Well, she is... she's been on the podcast. She was actually one of the first guests this year. But, you know, she has built and exited three agencies, right?
Yeah.
And actually, when she came to thinking about raising a fund, she decided against it because she wants to invest in great businesses. She's not looking for that necessarily that VC kind of like outlier style exit opportunity. But, you know, she's massively successful in her own right. And, like, if we created another 100 Emmys, right?
Or Emmy-style businesses, for the economy, absolutely, and for employment. I think what we need to get better at, so in America, there is AngelList, which we have over here, but not to the same way. And we've got companies that are trying to do it over here.
So we have like Odin, Vobo,
and stuff like that. Yeah. But it's not that they can't build the tech, it's that the compliance behind the scenes is way stricter over here than it is in America. I think in certain states in America, you can just raise $10 million you know, from 10 people and then go and distribute.
Maximum 100 people, but yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
you know, and you just can't, it's really hard to do that here. You know, so I think that is a big blocker.
Well, plus we also had the sort of restrictions on the pensions, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, the British Business Bank, which ends up as being the cornerstone for most of these funds, won't do anything less than 25 million, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right?
Because the economics of it don't make sense, right?
Yeah.
So if you can put money in the hands of these sort of micro funds,
emerging managers on the ground,
making small checks. I think that's. I mean, it doesn't solve the problem of the scale, and we definitely do struggle in that. You know, sort of like the 15, 20 million pound rounds plus. But I think that really, really early stage, we need to make that as easy as possible. And look, we're one of the best places in the world for it, right? With SEIS and EIS. But I just think making funds easier to set up and easier to structure would be a huge enabler to improve that.
I mean, the argument, so I agree with you. I mean, SEIS, EIS means that at the early stage, pre-seed, lots of businesses can get back because obviously there's that tax efficiency.
Yeah.
But what you have is investors that aren't necessarily kind of looking for those massive returns. They just like, oh, okay, this is a tax break for me. I can take advantage of that. That's fine. I think as the ecosystem matures, that'll probably improve. Again, agreed, like at the later stages, there's just not that growth capital as there is in the US.
This is why I think putting money, you know, I think personally for a lot of angel investors, it'd be better for them to put their money into these micro funds.
Sure.
Because the deal flow's going to be better, their DD's going to be better. It's not going to be, you know, their friend's cousin's dog that's starting something and they're just chucking 25 grand in. So you see a lot of bad investments because of the SEIS and because of the EIS tax breaks, it's almost like a curse in as much as a benefit. And another big challenge of that is that the rounds, a lot of those early stage rounds are too high.
Yeah.
You know, so they've done a pre-seed at 3 million, and then they're coming to people like us saying, well, you know, we want to raise at 4 or 5. Well, yeah. You haven't got, you know, you've got
There's
5 grand a month
there.
Of revenue. What are you talking about? Oh, because I did my friends and family round at this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you shouldn't have. So I think if we can make those micro funds easier to set up, I think more angels putting their money into them and that sort of funneling through to the to early stage companies, I think that will make a big difference.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think we're in a place right now where obviously the last couple of years there have been some of these funds raised. I think what may happen, and I hope it doesn't, is if those funds don't have success, then it'll just set us back again another sort of several years.
I mean, there's going to be a big correction with those funds, right?
Yeah. Well, the funds and the startups that have been invested in. And we're seeing that sort of starting to happen now. So just as we kind of close off the conversation, and you've mentioned this a couple of times, right? But with the explosion of generative AI and previously no code tools, right? One could argue that software is no longer a moat, right? Or it's certainly less of a moat.
Mm.
Do you agree with that? And how should founders think about approaching this new paradigm?
So I totally agree with the point. It's not so much a moat anymore, but it's even more of a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yes, it's I think exactly what you said. It is less of a moat. It can't be, you can't go in and say, oh, you should invest in us because we've got tech. They're like, yeah, well, obviously everybody needs to have that. But everyone now has that. So that's why, you know, our mindset is going to, we'll go after the industries and go after the companies that don't have that, because actually in their industry with an existing business, maybe it will be a moat for them, you know. So, you know, going after a company that's been going for 10 years, that's doing £3 or 4 million of revenue, putting tech and putting AI into that company, that is a moat. Right?
Yeah.
That is a moat for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an interesting time. You know, we're trying to get our head around it as much as anybody else at the moment. But exciting, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the things that are obvious, you know, well, I say obvious, the things that make sense to me are, one, I think we're going to see a drop in the cost of development. So, like, I think whereas you maybe needed to hire 5 engineers, you might hire 3, right?
Correct.
Because you can get...
Yeah, the efficiency gains with even stuff like Codepilot that we're using now is making massive differences already.
I would imagine, right? And it also means that kind of cold start problem is less of a problem, right? You can get from zero to something that much quicker as a founder, even as a non-technical founder, right?
Correct.
Like, and I've built very crappy microservices using ChatGPT. And if I spent a bit more time, I could probably build okay microservices using it. And if I actually knew what I was doing, I'd probably build very good ones, right? Mm. And I think there is a window of opportunity as well, I would say, is the other thing, right? Because
Correct.
I think at the moment, this stuff is so new, people are kind of getting on board, but they're not quite sure. There are some companies that haven't quite figured out what their digital strategy is, how they can build AI into that strategy, how they can use no code and so on. But I think within the next 2 years, that window starts closing, or if it hasn't closed already, because if you haven't by then, you're probably not going to be able to, or someone else has already overtaken you.
Yeah, right? And the danger of sounding like a broken record, I think the opportunity is not just in the front end and what happens with customers.
Yeah.
It's behind the scenes for companies. How can you automate things? How can you create efficiency gains? Because, you know, if you can improve your gross margin from 30 to 70%, with using harnessing all that technology, you are, you know, fundamentally a different business.
Yeah.
So I think it's understanding the use cases and how you can harness it within existing businesses, which is where there is this enormous opportunity that, you know, most people are not taking advantage of yet. And you say we're on a clock, you're right, but you're talking about probably a 5-10 year clock.
Yeah, that's fair.
Before people work, you know, really work that out.
I think there is so much that we could continue to talk about. Like I kind of want to spend another hour thinking about how to digitize everything that I'm doing, but maybe we should take that offline. Matt, it's been absolutely incredible
having you here
in the studio. No, it's been wonderful. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? You're on LinkedIn, are you on Twitter?
LinkedIn, founderoflightning.com. Or my LinkedIn. Very interested in investing in founders at the moment that I've got either a scrappy MVP that they want to digitize, so they might have built something on no code or spreadsheets and they've proven early traction, or they've got an existing business that we can help them digitize.
Amazing. Matt, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been
Pleasure.
Amazing.
Thank you.
Excellent.